Okay, so you know I love good wordplay. And Third Love is crushing their wordplay here. When you have a bra that pinches or slips or just isn't comfortable at all, or is comfortable but isn't your style, you've got problems. How excited was Third Love when they thought of problems? Well done, Third Love. I see you. When you wear Third Love bras, you've got no problems. They fix the problem of size exclusivity with their famous half-cup sizes that revolutionized the industry by giving more options to find a bra that fits. And they fixed the problem of guessing what bra will fit you with their virtual fitting room and other helpful guides. A bra size chart, a bra 101 education section that's basically an FAQ for all your burning questions, and a ton of great reviews from real people. My sister just texted me 99 problems, but pinching isn't one. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with code PODCAST15.
If you want to learn something new, would you rather learn it on your own, from a random teacher, or from folks who are the best of the best in that skill? I think I know which option most of you would choose. That's made possible by MasterClass. In recent months, they've added classes from the likes of Ava DuVernay, who gives us tips on how to reframe our thinking in all walks of life. One of our personal favorites recently was the one-on-one time we got with Amy Poehler in her class on preparing to be unprepared. So good. With Ava DuVernay. With over 180 world-class instructors and a 30-day money-back guarantee for new members, there's no reason not to get started today. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/hardthings. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/hardthings. masterclass.com/hardthings.
I chased desire. I made sure I got what's mine.
No choice
but to hear you.
You stated your case
time and again.
I thought about it.
You already won me over in spite of me. And don't be alarmed if I fall
head over feet.
And don't be surprised if I love you for all that you are. I couldn't help it. It's all your fault.
We did not plan that.
Honestly, I think there are like two musicians in the world that I remember the songs to, and Alanis is one of them.
Okay. Now, since no one is listening anymore and everyone has turned off our podcast.
I mean, for sure we're cutting that, but fine.
I don't think we are. I do not think we are.
I'm so embarrassed.
Today, we can do hard things, we have the Alanis Morissette. Alanis Morissette is one of the most influential singer, songwriter, musicians, and artists in the world. Her deeply expressive music and performances have earned multiple awards, including 7 Grammy Awards, and she has sold over 75 million albums worldwide and was inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame and the Canadian Songwriter Hall of Fame. Her debut album, Jagged Little Pill, was followed by 9 more eclectic and critically acclaimed albums. Her artistic impact can also be seen via the 2-time Tony Award-winning Jagged Little Pill, the musical, which our family has seen twice or thrice.
I've seen twice.
I think I've seen it thrice.
No, I've seen it once. You saw it in New York, and then you saw it here. Yeah.
Which continues to tour globally. This summer, Alanis will be on the Triple Moon Tour. So exciting, with special guests, Joan Jett. That's why I hate myself for loving you.
Such a disservice we're doing them.
And Morgan Wade.
Joan Jett and the Blackhearts.
Oh, right. Joan Jett and me.
And Morgan Wade.
And the Blackhearts and Morgan Wade.
And Glennon.
Get more info at Alanis.com/events. Hello, sweet Alanis. How are you?
Too.
Hi.
Oh, hi. My God. I'm so excited to finally meet you. How are you?
So nice to see you both. I'm really well, actually.
Oh, good.
I can safely say. How are you?
Good. I think we're wellish, too. Do you think?
We're very well, yes.
I think we're wellish. I'm feeling...
Wellish.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm feeling wellisher than usual because, first of all, we've been huge fans just for absolutely ever, like the rest of the world. Not just of the music, of everything, of the meditation album, of the musical. We've seen it twice with our family.
Oh, wow.
But beside all of that, I have to tell you that I, in preparation for this interview, I started...
Rabbit holing?
Yes.
She went down.
I'm sorry, and you're welcome.
Yes.
I feel like I've been on your path of healing, and I kind of thought you were like an incredible student of people in the world, and then you turned into this teacher, and I feel like you have done so much work down so many rabbit holes of your own.
Yes.
That I have a simple goal for this next 50 minutes with you, which is to synthesize the human experience.
no pressure. That's very kind. And I think pithifying is a thing, right?
Yeah.
My main intention behind it, though, is that not everybody wants to read as much as some of us do, us biblio peeps. Mm-hmm. But we're all experiencing the human condition, which includes despair and suffering. So if there can be some alleviating of that through distilling and just taking all the knowledge and the millions of models and having created some of my own over the last while, it's a service, you know, just showing up, and you do it every day, you too. It's an ethos. It's an orientation. It's a worldview. I think of us as filters, you know, there's the course of the animating force that runs through all of us. And I think at varying speeds, some of us it's coursing through really quickly and we have to be semi-responsible for that. And then some of us, it moves more slowly. Mm-hmm. So in my case, it definitely moves quickly. And I just have to be aware of that and take responsibility for it. Process enough, you know, have enough people around me to process with, bandy things about with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
God bless community.
If there is a community of highly sensitive people, they are our people, like everyone listening now, right?
Yes. Oh, good.
If you have lasted this long with this podcast, you are likely.
People ask, you know, who comes to your shows? You know, who are my people? And it sounds like there's an overlap in temperament, proclivity, how our brains work. Highly sensitive, a lot of empaths. Yes. So 20 or 30% are highly sensitive.
Yeah.
Of that 20, 30%, 4% statistically are empaths as well.
Mm. I did not know that. Can you talk to us about that whole thing you just said? Like, what is a highly sensitive person? What was your life like before you knew that's what you were?
Mm.
And just take us down this road for people who don't know what this is.
Yeah. So I always felt something was wrong with me. We live in a world that basically praises, as you both know already, praises extroversion, basically. And I would look at these people who seem to let everything slide off their back. You know, I just think, what do they have? What do they know that I don't? Because I feel everything so intensely. And I've now been able to sort of organize it a little bit in categories. Like, there's the macro sense of what's happening in the world that is felt in my body and those of us who are empaths. There's the immediate microcosmic interaction with spouse, family, friends, colleagues. And then there's this whole energetic, and here are all these parts that, you know, they want my attention a lot. Just kind of fielding all of that and then realizing, you know, there's people like Rose Tree. There's some beautiful books that are being written about being an empath now. And the distinctions weren't really clear for a while because I think in the neurobiology communities, the psychotherapeutic community, they poo-pooed temperament. They didn't even want to bring it into any conversations. Mm-hmm. And I kept going, but how could it not be taken into consideration with education for kids, with programs for adults? How could it not be taken into consideration? It's a big part of the epicenter of our filter. So I think it's becoming more normalized now. And I've even heard in television shows, people saying, well, I'm an HSP. So yeah, I'm a 4 on the Enneagram.
Same.
All the self-knowledge tools that are out there in the world, I think they're so powerful for us to embrace, not just for entertainment, although it can be wildly entertaining and hilarious, but for the self-knowledge so that we know where to put ourselves. We know how to live our purpose in a way that is sustainable for mm-hmm. our bodies and our well-being. Although I'm careful with the use of well-being these days, because mm-hmm. it can be another term that we use to beat ourselves up.
Yeah.
So I think about wholeness. You know, mm-hmm. I'm on the wholeness journey. I'm not on the wellness journey, although sometimes it looks like a wellness journey. Mm-hmm. You know, the perfectionism comes in and wants to just co-opt the whole wellness journey sometimes. So I'm like, let's maybe not use that word.
Yeah, it sure does. Doesn't it? Okay, so you just thought something was wrong with you. And then did you find a book about being an HSP? Was it Elaine Aarons? Did she sweep into your life and say, okay, here's the four characteristics of a highly sensitive person? And you were like, oh, I'm not
jacked up. You had me at the acronym. Okay. Yeah. Someone gave me the book, the Highly Sensitive Person book. And when I first got it, I was seeing still through the lens of patriarchy and extroversion centricity. And I didn't actually want to read it. And then a few years later, there it was. And I read it and it's in its entirety. And I was just weeping the whole way through out of recognition and just thought, oh, this explains a lot. Then I just talk about rabbit holes. I just wanted to go more deeply and deeply and deeply. And a lot of times I would think, well, I'm an extrovert because I love humans. I love conversations. I love listening. And I've come to see that introverts and highly sensitives and empaths, we light up when we're around like-mindeds. Mm-hmm. When we're not around like-mindeds, we can often be paused to check or just more observing, mm-hmm. more people watching. So it depends on context, as always.
So for those listening, the four characteristics of a highly sensitive person are the depth of processing, which means when Abby and I walk into a room and then we leave, and I'm like, do you not notice the 12,000 things that just happened in that room? And she's okay.
Abby, are you a non-HSP? Do you identify as non-HSP?
I do. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm married to an HSP. So that has been.
There's that.
Yeah. I mean, but it's like, I think that that's really important for this conversation is because so many people listening, you may be an HSP and you may not, or you might be married to one, or you might have a child who is an HSP. Mm. This is so important because this helps me be a better mm-hmm. partner.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, beautiful. And Elaine talks about, you know, the pros and cons of all couplings mm-hmm. and she's married to a non-HSP. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm married to a non-HSP. Mm-hmm. She actually mentioned, I think in the highly sensitive book that the highly sensitive person in love, she mentioned that the highest level of satisfaction, all in quotes, is two HSPs. But my running joke about that is that two HSPs will never leave the house.
How?
Or get out of their cozy clothes, or they won't stop ruminating. You know, it's like, good luck getting out of the house with two HSPs.
Exactly.
I can think of worse problems, by the way.
I mean, but I think an HSP with a non-HSP in a lesbian marriage, that might be like the middle ground.
Yeah.
Because you're both what, woman bodies?
We're processors. We like to go.
Okay. You're thinking women.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We say it's not enough to understand each other. We have to overstand each other.
Yeah.
We have to like.
Well, when people say over communicating or overstate, I always just think, oh, you mean communicating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've normalized under communicating so much. But the idea too of HSP, non-HSP, I think of examples like, if my husband and I are going to pick up food somewhere, you know, it's implied that he's going to go in and get the food with tons of people and that I'm going to wait in the car. I mean, it's implied that because you were mentioning a second ago, Glennon. So a non-highly sensitive, not to say insensitive.
No.
A non-highly sensitive temperament person will walk into a room and get 50 pieces of information. Mm. A highly sensitive person will walk into a room, especially if they're empath compounded, we'll walk into a room and get 500 pieces of information.
Wow.
So it goes without saying the acronym that you started laying out, that we can get flooded more easily, more quickly. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we're overly fragile, although mm-hmm. I love fragility. It's that there's so much information. And I actually have sought a lot of help around how do I calibrate the incoming influx of nonstop stimulation. And I even share it with my kids who are all HSPs. Mm-hmm. I share with them when they feel flooded and I'm noticing it, I just go, wow, it's a lot of information, huh? Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's sensual information. It's auditory, visual. There's a lot of Claire element that can come into empaths. Like, mm-hmm. you know, my kids hear people a block away, you know? Mm-hmm. And so really going into the senses a lot is a big deal. And in America, we focus on academia, intellectualism, and we focus on action. we don't always focus on the senses and we don't always focus on the feelings, mm-hmm. especially the angry, sad, scared. Mm-hmm. Those three just get such a bad rep. Mm-hmm. Like, they're gorgeous. They move worlds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things to me is that when we wonder why is this that 20% of people are like this? And then we find out that historically, the highly sensitive person's job was to pay such close attention that they would help the community avoid tragedy.
Everything.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us? Because I actually don't know at all the difference between we've got 20% that's highly sensitive.
They're saying almost 30 now.
Oh.
I think a lot of us are coming out of the woodwork.
We're coming out of the closet. Then how do you know if you're an empath within the HSP? Are all empaths HSPs?
All empaths are HSPs. Not all HSPs are empaths.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you know if you're an empath?
It's a pretty good chance you know because of the level of somatic overtaking. Mm. Like, I am somatically overcome when I see animals, when I feel a room that is unaddressed trauma, you know, and so much of this is none of my business, right? So
right.
for me, the maturation process is about tuning into something. And I come up with tricks. Rose Tree, she's sort of one of the OG empath women. She's got all kinds of cool tricks about, some of it is just, it looks like straight how to not be codependent, you know, but really it's how to be an empath and navigate so that it's a sustainable way of living where you can notice, but not be debilitated physically by it. For me, it's the begged question that can really elucidate it for me is, whose is this?
Mm-hmm.
So now we know we got our generational trauma and we've got our current traumas. We've got our planetary traumas. Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I'm feeling debilitated or I feel depression or a rage I can't explain, often the first question that I start with is, whose is this? Mm-hmm. Is this my mom's?
Mm. Yeah.
Is this my husband's?
That's
is this
good.
The school's? Mm-hmm. You know, and then just sort of rendering distinct what's going on helps. Mm-hmm. And then also the I notice, you know, so a lot of ways that you can tell that you're in an empath merge, it's actually called an unskilled empath merge. And I was in it all the time where I would see someone and I would almost like teleport into their experience to the point where I'd get home at night and I couldn't even move. One example to kind of get out of that mode is to close your eyes because staring is an indication. Mm. So Abby, if you see Glennon super staring, a little snip, snip, like, hey, what's going on? How we doing?
Wow.
How do you feel? What's going on in your body? You know, the orientation helps visually. What's happening in the body? What do I notice? Oh, I notice I'm hungry. Mm-hmm. I notice that I'm itchy on my shoulder. That brings us back into ourselves versus being outwardly oriented. That helps.
When I was traveling internationally for soccer, I didn't have time to come up with all sorts of travel itineraries when all I could think about were the matches we needed to focus on. But it was important to me that I saw the world while I was abroad. Viator can help with that in a big way. Everything from nature walks to guided history tours or adventure sports, all of it can be booked through Viator. Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book over 300,000 travel experiences around the world, no matter who you're with or where you're going. We've used Viator for family trips, and things like real reviews from fellow travelers really helped inform our decisions for which experiences to book. And because plans can easily change for a whole host of reasons, it was nice to know that free cancellation was available. So if you want to explore the globe or even your neighborhood in a new way, download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experience for you. Do more with Viator.
The opportunities for giving amazing life-changing gifts have just begun.
And yes, diapers are a life-changing gift. Imagine you're a first-time parent struggling with time management and financial burdens. Don't really have to imagine. I remember it directly. And all the challenges of your first child. And then you get a huge shipment of diapers funded by all your family and friends. That's a good feeling.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's exactly what Pampers is doing with their diaper stash. I love this so much. It's an online diaper fund. So you can contribute to a diaper stockpile and help ensure it never runs out.
And one of the most difficult things about buying diapers for others is making sure that you guess the right fits and sizes. And with Pampers Diaper Fund, all that guesswork goes away.
So if there's a new parent or expecting parent in your life, you will be making their lives a lot easier and showing them how many people are excited for their huge milestone.
Organizing a diaper stash is easy. Go to diaperstash.pampers.com to set up a fund and give the ultimate group gift. Love it.
Love it.
Love it. Love it.
Is it an empath thing to actually get physically sick about anything?
Yes.
You go down hard when something, especially in the world macro, as you talk about, when the stuff goes off in the world macro-wise.
Yeah.
Glennon will be in bed for 3 days.
Yeah. Or you're faking when you're out of bed because you really want to be in bed.
And you can imagine for all of you love bugs right now who, and we're going to get into this more this season, HSPs, don't worry, empaths, all of this. But you can imagine if you're a kid who's an HSP and you don't know you're freaking HSP and you don't know this is a whole way of being and all you know is you are constantly overstimulated. You think something's wrong with you. You are always dysregulated. You're looking for comfort and to self-soothe this way of being that no one understands. What might you become?
Yeah.
An addict of everything.
We're seeking relief from the onslaught of incoming information.
Talk to us about your experience with this, because it's not a coincidence that so many of us who start out with just these tender, big, wide open hearts and eyes, I have so many addict friends. I mean, I'm an artist and activist, so all my friends are addicts. And like, they get to the point where their families and their friends, everybody finds them so insensitive because they're behaving badly, right?
But when you're flooded, you're not at your best.
Yeah, but you start out as the most sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, self-absorption can really kind of steal all the prose of our temperaments and everything, right? And self-absorption is the great metaphor that I think of is when someone steps on your toe and it really hurts. We're animals. Our first instinct isn't to go, are you okay, person who stepped on my toe? Our immediate instinct, animalistically, is, ah, fuck, ow, right? Mm. Get off me. Mm. And then, oh my God, you know, so our self-absorption is from being in pain and it not having been addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, one of my questions to my therapist and people I work with is, with all this incoming information, I've had a really hard time feeling like I catch up to real time because there seems to be this unaddressed energies over here, the future vision of what's possible, the macrocosmic felt sense of what's happening in the world, the immediate stuff with my relationships. It's too much. And I just think, is there an end to this? And one of the sweet pieces of information I got just this week is that when one part is dialogued with and there's some healing happening, it affects all these other parts too, because they often come in clusters.
Mm-hmm.
So these parts, they're in pain. There's some wisdom they have for us if we have that interiority muscle to dialogue with them. It's basically the ability to kind of create space, because I just kept thinking, is there going to be an arrival point where I'm not flooded, where I don't feel like I have to catch up? And the answer is no, if I'm going with amounts of parts that want my attention. No, because I want to be in the world. I'm going to be exposed to all the incoming pieces of information. It's about organizing it. So I'm in this mode of attempting to organize it internally, because if I am aware of all the energies, I'm just flooded and I kind of shut down. So to put even categorically, like I'm going to put these energies in the past, I'll still deal with them, but they're in the past. They're over here. There's some disidentification, some stepping away, some space gotten rather than being completely blended and overtaken by it. And then there's the stuff from the future. And then in the present, there's this real stillness and spaciousness that allows me to function and not wait for both of these to be cleared up so that I can start living, if that makes any sense.
It does. And you're talking a lot about like internal family systems. It sounds like you're talking about the parts.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about that on this podcast. And actually, I was just talking with my therapist the other day about it. And she said something really beautiful to me. She said, so what we're trying to do in this work, Abby, is to turn the volume down on some of the parts of you that have been screaming and that haven't been serving you. So I love that visual, like just to turn that, like the volume down. But that's interesting that you talked about your parts as in past and in future.
Yeah, because I'm trying to organize it in some way. IFS isn't necessarily about relegating. It's about dialoguing and embracing. And Debbie Ford, whom I was very close with for a long time before she passed, it was, you know, for her, it was about connecting with what piece of wisdom do you have for me? What action can I take on your behalf? What do you need? Is there anything else? You know? And so it was a great sort of trailhead, to use an IFS term, a great trailhead in to loving these parts. You know, they're trying to protect, they're trying to seek relief, they're trying to manage the unmanageable, trying to keep everything in homeostasis. So even the ones that are super violent and cruel in there, they're doing it for a reason. So if we can get to that nucleus, it can shift and make it a little more friendly in here, you know?
Yeah.
And I used to just view these cruel voices as, you know, that's just part of being a human being. But when I've moved toward them by dialoguing with them and journaling or whatever it is, there's a deep wisdom in there and such goodwill, you know, these parts are just doing their best to keep it together for all of us. They're trying to make this system manageable. And sometimes they're doing it, as you said, you know, little wildly high volume. And Neil Donald Walsh used to say that too in the 90s. He'd be like, he's like, you know, I have this incredible quality, but when it's on 11, everyone hates me. When it's on 8, everyone likes me.
Yeah.
Just like, nice.
Well, and you can't turn the volume down on them until they're heard. Like they can't, you can't turn the volume down on them. I mean, And if you're listening and you're like, what the fuck are they talking about? It's like you have these parts and just very quickly and horribly. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that I had a part of me that did not want me to eat. That my anorexic self that I'm in just a year into recovery for now.
Nice.
And
congrats. Wow.
Thank you. And well, also 35 years of recovery.
Yeah, I mean, a whole lifetime.
This is the freshest version. Okay. This is
The current iteration of my.
And so you wonder, like, what is this part doing? Like, why is it telling me not to eat? Why? Turn it down, turn it down. No. 6 months in, it's saying, Glennon, your house wasn't a safe place to indulge your appetite.
Nourish.
Yeah. Like you. I was keeping us small and safe. Like, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to keep you small and safe. Like, I'm protecting you. And so it's like, you have these parts that did their best job, actually did a really good job.
Like, amazing job.
You survived.
Amazing job.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God. Good. Like, well
Thank
done.
You.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Like, now we're in a different place with different rules. The rules here are no longer that we can't grow. We have to slowly encourage this little precious protector to like take some risks now or like relax a little bit, but not until Alanis. I spent 6 months, and Abby knows this, just walking by myself. It was just a gentle walk. I was calling it an exile walk, and I had to like hear these voices. Like I had to hear, let these voices rise and talk that were trying to protect me.
Yes.
So these are the parts. They're all good. There's no bad parts. They just might be maladjusted now.
Yeah.
That's a good way of setting.
Okay. Yeah. Can you talk to us though? Because we have so many, the Venn diagram of sensitive humans and people who are in addiction or are recovering from addiction. When you talk about the human condition, we are sensitive, we are overstimulated, we are noticing everything, and we want to turn the volume down. So we find, talk about protectors, talk about things that we grab.
Oh, yeah. The managers are very, very crafty.
Yeah.
in the best way. Like they'll find ways to create relief. There's so many beautiful words for managers. And I call them relief-seeking creatures. Mm-hmm. Basically, and what is relief? Regulation.
Right. Exactly.
Anything that puts the eye on the prize of regulation, co-regulation, regulating as adults, doing it with our kids, doing it with our puppies, doing it with our parts.
How did you feel when you were dysregulated? I want to talk about what we go towards when we are doing our best to regulate, but we don't have all these skills yet. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of people out there who are grabbing the booze, filling the carts, doing the, who are just love bugs trying to regulate their nervous systems. How do you feel when you're dysregulated? And talk to us about your addiction journey.
Well, the best thing about drugs, alcohol, shopping, work addiction, love addiction, gnarly.
Yeah.
Withdrawal is gnarly. Is that it feels really, really good for the first 20 minutes and then it kills you dead. So for me, those 20 minutes were such relief that I didn't care about dying until I became a parent. Then I was like, oh, I have to kind of stick around.
Same.
Yeah. I want to actually be, I'd like to live to 127 now, whereas in the past, I didn't even care. So, but in terms of the relief that it offers, it really does. I mean, alcohol, as Byron Katie says, alcohol does its job. It's a neutral thing, you know, shopping, fashion, beauty, glamorizing, all of it. It's all neutral in and of itself, and how we use it becomes the more pointed relief-seeking measure. And it does. It offers relief for the first little bit, and then it ruins your life and ruins your relationships. So when my eye goes on relief-seeking measures that is more relational, you know, and some would say, well, tequila is relational. I'm my best self. No, you're turning into an extrovert. I mean, a lot of times I would drink tequila so that I could be another temperament.
And I
miss her sometimes because I don't drink anymore, but I'm like, oh, she was fun. But we'll find other ways to be fun. The definition of fun changes as we get older.
That's right.
But basically we get into a mode. We're chasing dopamine. We're chasing oxytocin. We're chasing serotonin. We're chasing the feel good, because there, it is a birthright for us to have some semblance of joy.
Yes.
In our bodies, you know, so we're chasing it, understandably. But these external means of satisfying something that can't be satisfied through external means, it's just a temporary blip, but we get a glimpse of it. We get a glimpse of what it feels like to feel joy or to have the serotonin go up, you know? So some of us who are empaths and HSPs also have a tendency to be depressed and anxious because we're not only exposed to this, all these energies, but there is a sensitivity to how the amygdala works in our brains, in our biochemistry and physiology. I often use the metaphor that I'm a shaky poodle inside a black stallion body. You know, like and they're constantly pedal brake, because I have the high novelty seeking, I want to jump off that cliff. I want to paraglide. I have motorcycles. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. And then also this part that's like tremoring and shaking after I ride my motorcycle, where I have to calm down for 45 minutes. So,
wow, that I'm a shaky poodle inside of a shaky poodle.
I just want to hold you and regulate.
On the outside I'm poodle, and on the inside I'm
inside
poodle.
Bubble. Well, that makes it really easy. No one misunderstands you and says, let's go cliff diving.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. So interesting though, because you do have that. I mean, my God, how do you be that dichotomy, that badass,
sweaty
Alanis Morissette on stage, and then you're a shaky poodle?
You know, therein lies the inquiry, a lifelong inquiry. And, you know, there's some Gemini stuff going on. There's some 4 on the Enneagram thing where I love variety. I love newness. I novelty seek all the time. Yeah, but then the poodle part needs the constancy, predictability, commitment. Yeah. You know, in my case, monogamy. Yeah. Like there's certain things that create safety for this. And so it's up to me to make sure that I carve that out in my life to the degree that it can be done.
What's the hardest part about being you and parenting?
The first thing that popped to my mind was how protective I am, because there's so many considerations about being in the public eye that I have to take into account and that are just so normalized for me now, whereas I see my kids processing certain things. And my eldest son will say, you know, Mom, in some ways it's cool to be your son, and in other ways it's just terrible. And I say, yeah, that's true. And I'm so sorry for the times where you're othered because of me, you know. But then there's pros too. You know, there's people who come talk to you who ordinarily might not.
Yeah.
You know? So, but for him to navigate it at a young age is really, it breaks my heart a little bit.
Yeah.
Because these are sophisticated considerations. The idea of fame and the effect it has on your life. Mm. That's an adult process, you know? Mm-hmm. So for kids to be subject to it, I just leave the door completely open for them to vent or say, well, that's cool, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, we'll be on the road and they don't want to come to the show and people around us will be like, they just kind of skip shows. I'm like, yes, this
yes,
is very normal for
God's
them.
Sake.
Of course they skip
yes.
shows.
Yes. Yeah. And I bet they're different. I mean, we have one who wants nothing to do with anything, is very private. And we okay. have another
who's like,
went to,
I love my baby.
Oh, yeah. She went to a soccer game when Abby couldn't go, a national team game when Abby wasn't mm-hmm. there with her friend. And mm-hmm. she held up a huge poster that said, I am Abby Wambach's daughter, so that she could get special attention. So they're different. The kids handle yeah. it all differently.
But temperamentally, probably quite
yes,
different.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And there's no right way to do it. You just have to like feel your way through it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And just process anything that comes up and stuff comes up. You probably deal with it every day.
Hungry Roots standard is simple but important. Step one, it's got to taste good. Step two, it's got to be quick to make. And step three, it's got to contain whole, trusted ingredients. And those three sound simple in theory, but when there's the option for takeout and there are stressful work days where meal prep isn't a priority, and when you've got picky eaters in the family, God help us, it's easier said than done. But Hungry Root makes it possible. We just built our first personalized cart after taking the fun little intro quiz, and soon my fridge will be filled with dairy-free snacks and drinks for John and the kids, prepared heat-and-eat meals for the whole family, and other high-quality groceries they're shipping over. I can't wait. Right now, Hungry Root is offering We Can Do Hard Things listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Did they say free veggies for life? Just go to hungryroot.com/hardthings to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/hardthings. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. Pod Squad, we know about you. You, like us, pamper your pups with clothes, fluffy beds, toys all the days, any little thing their goodest hearts desires. Why then would we settle for burnt, smelly pellets in their dog dishes? Maybe you don't. Maybe you go with the farmer's dog like I do for Seamus, and you reap the benefits of giving your dog real, fresh, healthy food. It looks like real food because it is real food. It's made with human-grade kitchens with the same gentle cooking you'd use if you were preparing meals for your family. It's even fun signing up. You answer questions about your dog, like what health issues they might have, how old they are, what breed and personality they have, and more. You're not only getting fresh, pre-portioned food, you're getting fresh, pre-portioned food for your specific dog. And your dog may just have a newfound respect for their human too. Get 50% off your first box of fresh, healthy food at www.thefarmersdog.com/hardthings. Food made in human-grade kitchens with the same gentle cooking you'd use if you were preparing meals for your family. Maybe more. Get 50% off your first box of fresh, healthy food at www.thefarmersdog.com/hardthings. Okay, y'all, I'm here to tell you about a movie you've got to check out. It's called Challengers. It's by the amazing filmmaker Luca Guadagnino, who you'll know from Call Me By Your Name, another gorgeous film. It is starring the fierce and ridiculously wonderful Zendaya. She is in it with Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist. And it's about this woman who is a tennis genius. And when she gets taken out of the game because she's hurt, she transforms her husband into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. He just so happens ends up across the net from his former best friend and her former boyfriend, Patrick. It is all about jealousy and rivalry and love. And most importantly, it is one of those rare films that centers around a woman's fierce competitive fire and heart. It is gripping and sexy, and you're going to want to check it out.
See Challengers Now, playing only in theaters. You can get tickets now at challengersmovie.com.
What are your best non-maladaptive strategies now for thriving as a highly sensitive person?
I'll just kind of point form it with you. Tons of breaks. And Elaine Aaron, that's one of the first things she recommends too. Just breaks. And for me, the breaks have to include a door click. There's something about pin drop silence and solitude that is instantly rejuvenative. That's a bit of an introvert thing. Mm-hmm. The theory being that how we recharge our batteries is solitude, and how an extrovert recharges their batteries is through interaction and social interaction. Mm-hmm. So for me, if I could have breaks throughout the day where I can take a deep breath and just be quiet, that helps sustainability. Body stuff, anything somatic. So my value system is, number one is the triadic connection. So connection with source, other, in here, those three. Number two is self-expression. It could be picking an orange t-shirt. It could be writing an email. It could be writing a chapter, whatever it is. And number three is body, somatic embodiment stuff. So I've been disassociated most of my life and mired in fantasy. It's been a great survival strategy. Also helps art. But to come back in here has been a big deal. And that's one way that I make being an HSP empath work. Like, okay, this, I can attune proprioceptively to raising my third toe, you know, and I just play with that. I play with sensation. I play with musculature, the skeleton, all of it, like just being able to use my imagination instead of for fantasy, use it for imagining parts of bodies and muscles that I want to have, you know, activate this movement. Or so a lot of body stuff has been incredibly helpful. Somatic experiencing, all of the juicy stuff, silence, recharge moments, processing. You know, I'm not always around people who are up for processing nonstop all the time, but when I am, it is pure joy. Yeah. So processing anything, you know, my son and I are both pretty intensely HSPs. And when a movie's finished, we'll sit there obsessively watching the credits while all my non-HSP friends are ready to go. They're like, let's get out of here. Yeah. You know, so just in moments of just letting myself slow down to move fast is a big one too. Because this lifestyle can really have a lot of hurry in it.
Yeah. You just said something that really brought something really big to the top for me. And as a non-HSP person who is married to an HSP, I am often put in positions where I have to take some solitude because Glennon requires it. And what I have realized that maybe I'm not so non-HSP as I thought, because the solitude that I take, I'm now choosing to do it for myself. And the world that we live in, it, you know, it celebrates extroversion.
And noise. And the noise pollution is incessant.
And I think it's important for people who might not necessarily relate to all the HSP things that we've said, that if you would identify as a non-HSP, to give yourself some of that solitude to see, in fact, because maybe I'm just like wearing a big ass costume.
Yeah, you never.
Because I do feel like I am sensitive, but I don't think that I'm as highly sensitive as you. I just had that thought and I'm like, what if I've been faking it all these years? Because that's what was affirmed in me and how to become successful in the way that I
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, there's a lot of HSPs who don't consider themselves to be HSPs because it's not culturally allowed.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so that could be interesting.
I think that I've learned so much from Glennon and the way that she needs to regulate, that even though I don't need to regulate in the same ways, I still need to regulate because I still get dysregulated. Like even if you're not an HSP, we're all getting dysregulated every day. Your kid walks in from school and they tell you a bullying story. And like, I'm like,
activation.
Exactly. Yeah. So all of these things are still so applicable to even those of us that wouldn't necessarily consider themselves HSPs.
I couldn't agree more. And my husband would be fist bumping you right now because you still have a nervous system.
Yeah.
You are still subject to dysregulation.
Yeah.
And so all it really means to me is that HSPs and empaths, their dysregulation, the felt sense is so fudging intense But Abby, what you just said is so true, because nervous systems are nervous systems. Mm-hmm. So one might have a felt sense of hyper intensity to the point where it's debilitating. Mm-hmm. And another might be super dysregulated on the verge of a panic attack, but they're sort of okay to some degree.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You consider yourself a recovering love addict and work addict.
And a few others.
Yes.
Yeah. But those, most of them, actually.
Most of them. I love that.
Yeah.
And you've had food and body stuff, right?
Yeah.
I have a lot of them too. And alcohol was hard to beat, but then easier to keep, because it's like so easy to just not do it. I mean, after 27 right. years of sobriety, you can, there are things you can just cut out.
Right.
Food, love, work, trickier.
Yeah.
How do you manage recovery from love addiction and being married and in love? And how do you handle being a work addict and being such a creatively and being engaged a worker bee. Work? Yes. How?
I can always tell when I've jumped the shark. So I'll be working, clickety clickety, super inspired. And then I can feel where it shifts into like not a full blown mania, but a white knuckle. And so in those moments, I'll pause and go, am I done? I've been working on this for a couple hours. Do I need a break? Am I finished? Versus just forget breaks and work addiction. So Brian Robinson has been huge support. The food conversation. Every time I meet someone with an eating disorder, I always feel like they're the smartest people with regards to nutrients. And, you know, it's almost like there's an extra steeliness for those of us looking at food stuff because we have to eat. And, you know, you could avoid alcohol, not to downplay how challenging it is to stop drinking alcohol. But with food, it is part of your day to day. Karen Koenig, a bunch of people who really basically saved my life. But it's an ongoing thing. This isn't like, oh, I worked on my eating disorder for 6 years. I'm good. You know, it still comes up.
Yeah.
And I can tell with food, with work, I can tell when the camera has a Dutch angle and it starts turning into something that is fear-based, that is hungry, that is angry, as opposed to just inspired.
Yeah.
I can feel it in my body. So there's the somatic indication. And then how to be a recovering love addict in relationship. I mean, there's no better way to recover from love addiction than to be in a relationship where there's enough functionality and enough support from couples therapy or otherwise. I love IFIO. It's basically IFS mixed in. There's enough safety to begin with, provided often by a therapist in a triangle, that it can be explored in real time versus the pain of love addiction, which is the cycle keeps happening and the abandonment keeps happening. So it's just compounding. You got your past trauma, then you got your current ones because you're repeating the pattern. And Pia Melody just knocks it out of the park with love addiction recovery. I mean, she's just got the seminal model, and I've been following it for years and bow down to her because she gets it from the inside out. And then eating disorder, Richard Schwartz's wife is writing an IFS informed eating disorder recovery book. I can't remember the title right now, but very excited about that because it's its own eating food, anorexia, bulimia, recovery from it. It's its own world. It's hard to describe. And there's some beautiful books out there. I think there's one called Talking to Eating Disorders. There's some books that can really help elucidate what it's like for someone who's on the outside watching someone with an eating disorder. But with postpartum depression, depression in general, love addiction, and food addiction, it's a tough one to articulate unless you've experienced it. I will always try. I'll chase it. I'll try to articulate it. But that one is, if you've been inside of this, there's a knowing.
Yeah.
There's a knowing empathy.
I think that work addiction and love addiction are going to be the next big things that people start to identify in their lives. I think it's going to have a moment because they're the things that are so celebrated.
The praised addiction, it's called.
Right.
You know, because I think about it too, like, if I were staying up till 4 a.m. doing crystal meth or heroin, everyone would go, oh, we should maybe rally around her and check her out, you know. But if I said, oh, my 19th day in a row working till 4 a.m., I would get probably some high fives. Good work, Alanis. So you're praised. And you're dying. You're still dying.
And that's another thing that maybe helped you in childhood. that maybe now doesn't anymore.
Yes. Yes. And also depending on our age and when, how we were influenced culturally and societally at the time. I mean, the 90s, being children of the 70s, you know, that was a white knuckle culture. Mm-hmm. You feel scared, keep going. You feel tired, keep going. You feel sad, I don't care. It was this very needless, autonomous imperative that we were all indoctrinated with. So we're just taking that off now too.
Wait, say more about that. So like this might be, say you were raised by a football coach who would say, you can rest when you're dead, Glennon. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay. So a white knuckle generation. So you believe we were raised by a generation where that was the ethos.
A needless.
Okay.
A needless and feminine hating. That's still happening. So patriarchy basically is hatred of the feminine. Mm-hmm. You know, and the feminine is what's going to bring us all to salvation, because we know how to use all these multitasking capacities and come up with solutions. In days of old, they used to go up to women who were premenstrual in the villages and ask her opinion about the system or society, because they knew that the woman wouldn't mince words and she'd bring a profound wisdom, a profound intellect, profound vision that would positively influence the villages that were going to these women for these opinions. Mm. That's an example of making the feminine and making our biochemistry and our hormones work for us, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to sort of downplaying and vilifying the female experience, mm-hmm. holding it up.
Mm. Yeah. And also when you're saying the feminine, you're not just saying women, right? You're saying mm-hmm. like the energy that's inside of all of us. What do you mean when you say the feminine?
The feminine is all the feminine qualities, mm-hmm. feeling, intuiting, visioning, receptivity. So if you're going to channel some profound wisdom, mm-hmm. you're in your feminine, mm. because you have to listen for it, listen and maybe heed. So the action part is the beautiful masculine in all of us, which I live for, mm-hmm. empowered masculine. So I think of it in terms of empowered feminine, disempowered feminine, empowered masculine, disempowered masculine. Mm-hmm. And that's also, you know, the term toxic masculinity, all of it. Mm-hmm. It's a disempowered masculine, because an empowered masculine wants to provide, serve, uphold, protect, mm-hmm. care for, mm-hmm. offer, generosity, you know, mm-hmm. and then the empowered feminine is all of those things. Plus, you know, basically the empowered feminine is profound leadership, taking everyone to account, not stopping until there's win-win. There's no deal to be made here until we're done. And I laugh with my family because I really think the power of negotiating in any context is a powerful, it's a very feminine one, because the feminine waits until everybody's winning before she moves forward. Mm. So the idea, even in our living room of, you know, you want Mexican, you want Italian, you just want a peanut butter sandwich. Okay, so let's take that extra 3 minutes, which can feel like 3 years for some of them, to find out what the win-win is. And we always get there. Mm. But the feminine leadership is the leadership that takes everyone into account. Mm. And those are the leaders I want to follow or be next to.
That's right.
How is your recovery? Are you a 12-stepper?
I love 12-step, but I am... I mean, not unlike religion and psychotherapeutic models, and I just say yes. Like, how do you feel about this mm-hmm. model? Yeah, I'm definitely the toolkit woman. Like mm-hmm. everything's in my back pocket, everything I know anyway. And I pull it out. It's just an ongoing journey. I remember asking Gabor Mate, I was like, does this end? Is there a seminal moment where the healing is like, check, and now we party? I think he gave me a couple different answers, probably depending on the level of humor in our interaction. But I think eventually he said yes. I think what it is, it's not that we don't get dysregulated. Mm-hmm. It's that we now have ways of managing it. And my spiritual practice and my body practice are inextricably linked. So, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. things like heat, mm-hmm. hot mat, mm-hmm. strength training, all of that, they're all linked in with the spiritual practice.
Yes.
And so for me, to the degree that they can all be integrated, that is part of the recovery. And the 12 steps to me is just a profoundly soulful invitation. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go through every step, it's just it's a connective model.
Yeah, everybody
so
can
I'm
use
all
it.
About that.
And what is it that we're recovering? When you're like, when does it end? Because look, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I just know I'm doing something. And it is a lot of fucking work. But like, yeah, I'm not sure what I'm doing. But I'm doing something that is, it's working.
Yeah.
It's helping.
Yeah.
And what are you noticing? Like when you do the work, how do you know it's helping? Like, what do you see? What is going on around you?
So one of the things that I've been so fascinated with this past year of eating disorder recovery is that I think what I'm recovering is like the person that I was meant to be.
Like who you actually have
who
always
I
been.
Actually am. Yeah.
And by the way, that's the best part of getting older as a woman too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, I'm actually just returning. Mm-hmm. Just returning to what was always here the whole time. And I was chopping it off, or I was denying it, or I was told to hide it, or I was told to have shame around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like just they're all coming home.
Yeah. It just feels like an emerging of, and it's something that, like, if someone said, how's your eating going? I could tell you that, you know, this is how much weight I've gained and that's all. Yay. Great. But it shows up in my relationships. Like it shows up in how I act without thinking, like I'm just different.
And can you give me some words?
Like I'm,
there's more space or there's more.
Yeah. I'm calmer.
Calmer. So more grounded. Yeah.
I trust my judgment.
Nice.
I've spent my whole life being like, oh, I can't possibly know that. I don't know how that works. I don't know how that works. I don't know how that I'm creative. So like anything else, I can't.
Right.
And now I'm like, no, I'm actually good at things. I actually can understand.
You have access.
Spreadsheet. Yeah. I can understand. I can do basic math. I can figure out, like, I can do shit.
I got this new piece of technology. Just give me 4 days. I got this.
Yeah. No. All right. Slow down.
Technology.
But I'm just.
That's a quick text to somebody. So spaciousness, groundedness, calm.
Agency.
Agency is great. Juicy.
Yeah. Trust. Self-trust. Like, I feel unafraid. I think it's hard to be present in a moment or a day or a relationship if you don't know who you are and don't trust that you've got yourself.
That there's some response ability, you know, that I can actually respond and that I have access to. And there is some spaciousness, some slowing down so that I can actually tune in to my yes or my no and all of those.
That, because it's like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going to be friends with anybody. I made my life so small because I don't think I understood that I could do whatever I wanted at any moment. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to a get together. Okay. So I'm talking to my friend, Liz. Mm-hmm. She's helped me through my recovery in different ways. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to a thing. She's like, what? I'm like, I'm going to go. I got invited to a thing. I'm going to go to it. Okay. So this is like big progress.
That's unlike you?
Okay. She's like, whoa. Okay. And I say to her, so like, what do I do if I, like, what if I'm there and I hate it?
Mm.
And she's like, Glennon, you have a driver's license and a credit card. Like, you are not stuck anywhere for the rest of your life. You are never stuck anywhere.
Mm.
Which means, like, if I can trust myself to decide what I want to do, when I want to do it, how long.
Yeah.
Then I can try things. If I can trust myself to know that this new person that I'm meeting 3 days in, I'm actually not digging this person and I'm out of there. That means I can go to coffee the first time. I don't have to cut every experience off before I have it because I can trust myself to make decisions as I go through it.
You'll be able to respond.
Yes.
It's the ability to respond versus just be triggered, which by the way, triggered is understandable. But I think the degree of healing can also be measured by the lessening of reactivity or the lessening of triggers. It's just informational. Mm-hmm. Not that there's anything wrong with those. They all make sense.
Yeah.
But less trigger, more contemplation, more taking the information and sitting with it. Because, you know, the tyranny of immediacy is pretty intense in culture. Like, you know, we need this in 60 seconds. It's like, really? Do you?
Yes.
Do you need it in 60 seconds?
Mm-hmm. That too. Boundaries.
I think one of the most impressive things that I've witnessed from the outside is the growing of trust of self that you've been exploring is so unbelievably seen now more in our children. Like this mom is now trusting herself to do shit that she wasn't normally doing, you know, for the first 10 years of some of their lives. And now the three of them are learning how to look towards themselves to figure shit out. Granted, it's still a work in progress, but I think that it's been one of the most revolutionary things for our children to watch you grow in the trust that you are developing inside of yourself, being of agency and having them watch and witness you do that. So they're like, oh, I guess I'll do this thing on my own.
Yeah.
And it's like just unbelievable to watch.
They're like, oh, she's good. We're good.
Yes.
They're like going to do shit. What they've decided to do in the last year, and it can't be a coincidence.
Yeah. One went to Berlin.
One's going to be a rock star. Yeah. What could go wrong? The third is like doing her stuff. Anyway, we're going to come see you on tour. It's so exciting.
It's so exciting.
Before we got on with you, I sang an Alanis song.
Is that your warm-up?
And a Joan Jett song. So don't worry. We're ready for the tour. We love you. We're going to be listening to everything that you do. Thank you for all of the healing work that you do to like just like bring it to everybody. Bring all of these brilliant things to the world. And you're just a love.
You're not just a rock star. You are so much more than that.
Yeah.
And all the work you're doing is just proof. And you do the work and it's totally obvious. And we're just so grateful for all that you've been doing.
Thanks, Abby and Glennon. Oh my God. I want to thank you both for just being huge avatars in the world. I just don't feel alone. So just knowing that you two exist in the world and you're doing, you know, your profound service everywhere you show up. Thank you both. Mm. It's such an honor to be here chatting with you both.
Hope we get to give you a hug someday.
Love to you
and your beautiful family.
Thank you. You too. Sending love to you each. Thank you for having
Thank
me.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Pod Squad. We'll see you next time, but it won't be with anybody as cool as Alanis. So come back anyway.
Yay.
If this podcast means something to you, it would mean so much to us if you'd be willing to take 30 seconds to do these three things. First, can you please follow or subscribe to We Can Do Hard Things? Following the pod helps you because you'll never miss an episode, and it helps us because you'll never miss an episode. To do this, just go to the We Can Do Hard Things show page on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And then just tap the plus sign in the upper right-hand corner or click on follow. This is the most important thing for the pod. While you're there, if you'd be willing to give us a 5-star rating and review and share an episode you loved with a friend, we would be so grateful. We appreciate you very much. We Can Do Hard Things is produced in partnership with Cadence 13 Studios. I give you Tish Melton and Brandi Carlile.
I walked through fire, I came out the other side. I chased desire, I made sure I got what's mine. And I continued to believe that free. time, but I'm fine.